Good morning, everybody, or whenever you get around to watching this. Together, we've been on a bit of a journey, wandering around the wilderness with the Israelite people, and we have been taking that journey through the Book of Numbers. So today, geographically, the people of Israel had arrived on the banks of the Jordan, so much of their physical distance travelling was over, and we've arrived at chapter 25. The husband will read the whole chapter and the words will appear on the screen, so you don't need anything and you don't need to have done any homework. I've divided the story of Numbers 25 into two. There is a story in the first five verses that we're going to look at, and then the rest of the chapter makes up a second story for us to look at. The thing that both of these stories have in common is that essentially they contain mostly sex and violence. Some of the Old Testament, particularly, can be quite graphic, down to earth, you might say, about such things. And therefore, I have given this chapter an 18 rating. On a serious note, if I'm honest with myself, some of the violence that occurs in the Old Testament is sometimes a problem. People question our view of a loving God when life appears to be held so cheaply, when people get punished and murdered in battles in the Old Testament. And so I want to be able to look at how we can actually use numbers to bring it forward to the 21st century. I'm going to take the view that although we start back in the Old Testament, we need to consider what the New Testament says before going on to try and make the leap to the present day. So, in theological terms, we're going to look at how we can look at numbers through the lens of the Old Testament, see what they understood it to mean in Jesus' day, so that we can then progress to see what it might mean for us today.
Moab seduces Israel. While Israel was staying in Shittim, the men began to indulge in sexual immorality with Moabite women, who invited them to the sacrifices to their gods. The people ate the sacrificial meal and bowed down before these gods. So Israel yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor, and the Lord's anger burned against them. The Lord said to Moses, "Take all the leaders of these people, kill them, and expose them in broad daylight before the Lord, so that the Lord's fierce anger may turn away from Israel." So Moses said to Israel's judges, "Each of you must put to death those of your people who have yoked themselves to the Baal of Peor."
So let's look at a map of the journey so far. The red line is supposed to represent a possible route that the Israelites might have taken in their wandering. It starts on the left, escaping from Egypt, and finishes near the top right, reaching the River Jordan. We just blow that bit up, we can see the place where this story today takes place, and that actually they are very close to that line that represents the edge of their promised land. So they are within sight of their goal. Last week's story told them that they'd arrived at the territory of the king of Moab, and he wasn't thrilled to see them. He saw them as a threat. He wanted to get rid of them. But he knew that actually their trump card was their God. He knew that they had an all-powerful God. And so his plan A was to attack the blessings that were on the people of Israel because of their God. So he called for the hero of last week's story, our donkey-owning celebrity seer, Balaam, who was known to be a deeply religious man who was in contact with lots of gods. Balaam, on the other hand, was not a servant of God. He was sort of out for himself. This plot, as we heard last week, failed. He could not overcome the Israelites by overcoming their God. Balaam was completely unable to curse the Israelites when God had put his blessing on them. This meant that there had to be a plan B. It's not clear from the passage we've just read, but further on in Numbers, this is alluded to. And actually in the book of Revelation, by the time you get to the very end of the Bible, it shows what the Jews of the day understood by the story that we've now looked at. It was Balaam who taught Balak to entice the Israelites into sin so that they ate food sacrificed to idols and committed the sexual immorality. They couldn't attack God, he was too strong, but the weakness was the people themselves. So instead of attacking God, they headed for the people. And it was Balaam's idea that he proposed to King Balak that he should send temptation in their way. This is one of the few places in the Bible where it refers to loose men rather than it always being women who were causing the trouble. It's also important to note that it wasn't simply the fact that they snuck off in the camp to misbehave, but that they actually misbehaved in the sense that they were unfaithful to God by eating the sacrificial food and taking part in the worship of other gods. So they're in a bad place. And this is where the violence then ensues. After the immorality comes the retribution, and many people were killed. So how do we understand that? The Apostle Paul was very well versed in all the stories of the Old Testament, particularly the first five books. And in Corinthians, he writes in his letter an explanation of how he sees incidents like this that took place out in the desert. He wrote, "Now these things occurred as examples to keep us from setting our hearts on evil things." People did what they liked, things went wrong, and there were consequences. My little picture shows, poor chap, that is the last hurdle in the race. He just has to get over that hurdle and he's won. Just like the people of Israel just had to cross the Jordan and they were into the promised land and they lost sight of what they were trying to do. They lost focus. Their priorities became different. They got lured away. And that sort of thing can just as easily happen today. There are examples of famous people who seem to be on the top of their game, where they would want to be, and then they lose it all to some indiscretion. All we can do when we pray the Lord's Prayer, as we will do today, is to take seriously the line that says, "Do not lead us into temptation, but deliver us from evil," because we are all vulnerable. Let's look at our second story.
Then an Israelite man brought into the camp a Midianite woman right before the eyes of Moses and the whole assembly of Israel while they were weeping at the entrance to the tent of meeting. When Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, saw this, he left the assembly, took a spear in his hand, and followed the Israelite into the tent. He drove the spear into both of them, right through the Israelite man and into the woman's stomach. Then the plague against the Israelites was stopped, but those who died in the plague numbered 24,000. The Lord said to Moses, "Phinehas, son of Eleazar, the son of Aaron, the priest, has turned my anger away from the Israelites. Since he was as zealous for my honour among them as I am, I did not put an end to them in my zeal. Therefore tell him, I am making my covenant of peace with him. He and his descendants will have a covenant of a lasting priesthood, because he was zealous for the honour of his God and made atonement for the Israelites." The name of the Israelite who was killed with the Midianite woman was Zimri, son of Salu, the leader of a Simeonite family. And the name of the Midianite woman who was put to death was Cozbi, daughter of Zur, a tribal chief of a Midianite family. The Lord said to Moses, "Treat the Midianites as enemies and kill them. They treated you as enemies when they deceived you in the Peor incident involving their sister Cosbi, the daughter of a Midianite leader, the woman who was killed when the plague came as a result of that incident.
So, here we go again. The sex followed by the violence. This time, it's a Midianite woman. This time, actually, it's two characters that are named. They are high-status people. They belong to their royal households. But this isn't going to be a Romeo and Juliet story where the two of them bring two warring factions together. Quite the opposite. This time, a woman is brought into the camp, and there is a suggestion that her proximity to the tent of the covenant of the tabernacle, where God was living, was violated. And this particularly incensed the high priest of the day, Phinehas, who was a descendant of Aaron. And that, I think, is where the significance of this story, over and above it certainly being a cautionary tale, comes into play. Picked out verse 13 as particularly interesting. He, referring to Phinehas, the high priest, and his descendants are given a covenant of lasting priesthood. The significance of this part of the story, I think, would have been used as a validation as part of their CV, their credentials, for high priests for centuries to come. Covenants were important deals between God and his people, and we usually study them in detail, pay a lot of attention to the fact that God had a covenant with Noah, for example, that he wasn't going to wipe out all of mankind, that he had a covenant with Abraham, that he would become the leader of a huge tribe of people. And yet this covenant, we don't seem to put so much store by. If you read through a lot of Numbers, and we've done a good job covering most of it, but there'd be some bits that we had to skip over, a lot of time and energy is put into describing exactly who this high priest should be, how he should behave, how he should dress, what he should be like. It was endorsing a hereditary line of males from the right family, of the right age, and without blemish. There would be those who wouldn't qualify for such a duty. So what happened to this priestly line, this covenant, when we wind forward to the New Testament? Who was high priest in Jesus' day? There was a high priest, and there was a very fancy temple, possibly the fanciest temple in Jerusalem that they'd ever had, built by Herod the Great. Caiaphas was appointed perhaps not so much by God, but by the Roman Emperor, but he certainly had connections with the right family and must have fitted the bill. Apparently his three predecessors were rapidly sacked by the Roman Emperor, so that might imply to us that he was a better politician and that he was prepared to get along with the Romans. So what happened to that high priest? Well, not only was he in charge of the rituals, the sacrifice in the temple, but also the money. And when Jesus came along, he made it fairly clear by his words and actions what it was he thought of the money changing and what was going on in the temple when he turned over the money changers' tables and tried to clear his father's house. It's in the letter to the Hebrews, those Jews that have become Christians, as they were presumably most worried by this question, what are we going to do now we haven't got a high priest to show us the way to God, to gain us his forgiveness? And in that book, it tells us that Jesus is now our high priest, that we don't need a high priest, a man in fancy clothes on earth, in order to be able to access God, in order to be able to access his forgiveness, even though we don't deserve it. And Jesus is described as our high priest. So if there is now a high priest in heaven and we don't require a temple or a high priest on earth, was that the end of the covenant and the end of the story? Again, there are references to human high priests, priesthood on earth. And the good news and the bad news, if you like, is that it is us, the followers of Christ. 1 Peter talks of a chosen people, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, God's special possession, that you may declare the praises of him who called you out of darkness into his wonderful light. We are now all the priests of God. What does that mean? We all need a new outfit. It means that we can all access God through our high priest in heaven. We do not need another human being, if you like, to give us permission. There is no holy place that we can't enter because we are not special enough. We can access God's forgiveness, undeserving as we are, again through Jesus, and we don't need someone else to allow or grant us that permission. We have, as is sometimes termed, a priesthood of all believers, and this is one of the main planks of the values of Fairfield Church, that actually we wish to recognise and acknowledge that everybody has special gifts and talents used for God, that everyone is equal in the priesthood. Doesn't mean we're all in charge. That would be chaos, almost certainly. Well, definitely be chaos. Doesn't mean we all have to do the same thing. Doesn't mean we can all make an equally good cup of coffee or be kind to small children when they turn up. But it does mean that we all have a status in God's eyes. I chose the heart-shaped picture of different people. It called itself a large, diverse group of happy people. Great, I thought. I've covered all ages, all ethnicities, and people who've gone mad with different coloured bottles of hair dye. But actually, should I have chosen all happy people? Does that suggest that even though we may all look different as priests, actually only those with bubbly outgoing personalities or that are content with their lives are fit for the priesthood of God? I think I've mixed up there. What I really needed was a large group of diverse people with differing moods and different personality types as well that you can't see. So I think there's two big difficulties when it comes to seeing ourselves as the priesthood of all believers. First is how we see ourselves. Often we are our own worst enemies, our own worst critics. And so actually having the confidence to see ourselves as God sees us, as clean, as valued, as his representative on earth, we don't do what we could do if we had that confidence and that assurance. Second problem is often recognizing it in others. We have preconceived ideas about those who should be in charge, those from whom we can learn, those who are the most worthy, if you like, those whom we would have elevated to the priesthood. Sometimes that needs breaking down. And there has been a lot in the news and a lot of feeling that we don't always view everybody in the same way. And we need to seek God's forgiveness and guidance on what we are missing in other people. So the reason most folk would say that being a Christian isn't necessarily just arriving at the start of a very long journey is that we need to change how we look at ourselves to see ourselves as how God would see us. And we need to change how we look at others to see them through God's eyes as to how he would value and cherish their gifts. At the end of the day, changing us is God's work with our willingness, and we can only pray that we would be shown what it is he wants us to do as part of his priesthood, and what he wants us to encourage others to do and recognize their gifts and talents that can only be used for him to strengthen what's going on. I do believe that Fairfield Church and many churches up and down the country will come back together at the end of this lockdown in a stronger position than they left, God willing.